Welcome to In the Hive, I'm Roger McDonough. Through the years on this show, and on other KCPW shows actually, we've had the privilege of drawing on the expertise of prolific Western historian Will Bagley. Bagley died last month at the age of 71 after a series of strokes, and he took with him his warm and infectious laugh, and also his incredible depth of understanding about the events in American history that have led to the present time. Though he left behind a huge body of work, books and articles and documentary contributions that allow us to access that understanding. A couple of years back on this show, Will Bagley helped us tell a sort of ghost story from Utah's past. A tale that, as you'll hear Bagley himself explain later in the program, was actually a fascinating window into a tumultuous period in Utah history. So for Halloween this week on In the Hive, we present the rebroadcast of an old favorite, the tale of early Salt Lake City grave robber Jean-Baptiste, with the help of the late, great Western historian Will Bagley. Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough.
And I'm Tim Pierce.
And today on the show for Halloween, we're changing up the format just a tad here to tell, well, a sort of ghost story.
Right, a ghost story, but one that comes from the annals of Utah's past. So, you know, it's part history and part legend.
Yeah.
And Roger, this is a story you first heard, uncannily, in a cemetery.
That's right. My first ever job was as part of the grounds crew at the Salt Lake City Cemetery when I was about 15 years old. And basically, I'd spend the entire day with a gas-powered weed eater cleaning up the overgrown weeds and grass around graves. And this was no small job because the city cemetery in Salt Lake's Avenues neighborhood is the largest municipal cemetery in the United States. It's huge. It covers 122 acres. There are about 125,000 people buried there. There's just really a lot of grass to cut. It's really big.
Dang. Tough job for young Buck McDonough.
Anyway, working the grounds crew at the city cemetery, you see a lot of graves, open graves, graves waiting for people to be put in them, graves that have just been filled in, and really old graves. You can't help but wonder about the process of burial and about all of the stuff that people have been buried with. And I don't remember when exactly, but some hot summer day during one of our short-lived water breaks, I was talking to one of the bosses of the grounds crew about just the idea of burial and, you know, all the stuff that people get put in the ground with. And he told me a version of the ghost story that we are going to tell today.
Yeah, cool. So,
should we just tell it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's Halloween. Let's tell a ghost story.
Let's do it. It starts with a man named Jean-Baptiste. And the way that I was told the story, back in the 1860s, Jean-Baptiste was the sexton of the city cemetery that I ended up working at. Sexton, by the way, just means head caretaker of a graveyard or even church grounds. It's an old English word. According to the version of the story that I had, Baptiste also, in addition to being a sexton, ran a clothing shop in the Pioneer Capital.
Interesting choice of profession. Couple of weird pair there.
Yeah, and it plays a big role in the story. One day, a fellow resident of Salt Lake City is walking by the clothing store that Baptiste runs, and on display at the front is a suit, and it's a suit that this guy recognizes.
Okay, all right. I'm picking up what you're putting down here. I get you.
It's kind of obvious. It's the suit that he buried his brother in just a few weeks before.
Uh-oh
is right. An investigation is launched. Baptiste, it turns out, has been digging up lots of people to steal their clothes and then to resell those clothes. And basically, as a punishment, Brigham Young, who's at the time kind of the authority figure here in Utah.
Right.
He has Jean-Baptiste branded with the words grave robber on his forehead, shackled with a ball and chain, and then banished to an island in the Great Salt Lake. It's Fremont Island, the middle of the Great Salt Lake.
Oofta.
Yeah, so the story continues. I mean, some time goes by, a few months maybe, or a year, I'm not certain, and then someone who is in charge of bringing out supplies or something to Jean-Baptiste goes out to the island and finds that he's not there. Somehow, he's escaped. And there had also been a little shack on the island, a kind of supply shed, that has been taken apart. And what becomes apparent pretty quickly is that Baptiste created a raft from that shack, and then he floated to freedom. Except, some years later, someone finds a skeleton with a ball and chain attached to it in the shallows of the Great Salt Lake. just feet from the shore. Baptiste didn't make it. He drowned really close to land and his freedom, but he didn't make it. And my boss at the city cemetery, in the sort of telling of this legend, said that some nights you can hear the clanking of the chains and the thump of an iron ball, and you can see a salt-encrusted figure wandering among the graves, and that's supposed to be Jean-Baptiste, the ghost of Jean-Baptiste.
Okay, I don't understand. If he died in the Great Salt Lake, why is he haunting the cemetery?
Yeah, I guess he was coming back to the scene of his crimes to kind of atone for the sins of his life, Tim. That's the best I can come up
okay,
with.
Okay, sure. Well, this whole thing, like, right, sounded a little hokey to me. And I'm sure, Roger, you were driven by journalistic curiosity to get to the bottom of this one.
Right. So you and I did some further research. We dug up some old newspaper articles to kind of see what we could see about this story, and we spoke to historians. Basically, we tried our best to verify the particulars, so to speak.
Right. We wanted to substantiate this fantastical fable with fact. And we found that the story of the supposedly ghoulish apparition Jean-Baptiste, a good portion of it's actually true.
Yeah.
He was a real guy who really worked for the city cemetery and really did dig up and rob graves. But the real story of this grave robber doesn't start with him at all, but actually with a guy named John W. Dawson. Dawson was the territorial governor of the Utah Territory in 1861, and was appointed by none other than good old Honest Abe himself.
President Abraham Lincoln. 1861, by the way, is the first year of the Civil War. It's also just 14 years after the arrival of the Mormon pioneers to the Salt Lake Valley. But as pioneer leader Brigham Young is building his kingdom in the West, things aren't exactly copacetic between the Mormon frontier dwellers and the federal government. Even just 10 years earlier, there was almost an armed conflict between the U.S. Army, the U.S. government, and the Mormons during the so-called Utah War.
Right, because if you remember, Mormons were kicked out of Missouri and then Iowa, and they left westward to try to find their promised land. So they settled in Salt Lake City and claimed the Deseret Territory. Brigham Young, who was the governor in 1850, tried to vie for statehood, but it would take 49 years for Utah to become a state.
Yeah, not until 1896.
Right.
But yeah, during much of the territory's early history, tensions ran really high over who would hold absolute power. Deseret becomes the Utah Territory just 3 years after the pioneers settled there. Brigham Young was the first territorial governor, and he was appointed by President Millard Fillmore, and that's, as you said, in 1850. But after him, the federal government started to bring in governors from outside of Utah, and the settlers in the state, well, in the territory at the time, they saw that as an encroachment.
And these territorial governors, appointed by the U.S. president, played a big role in the kind of relationship the two sides had, which now brings us back to Dawson in 1861.
The only president who really understood how to handle Brigham Young was Abraham Lincoln.
That's historian Will Bagley, editor of the 16-part series Kingdom in the West, The Mormons and the American Frontier.
And so he didn't appoint a guy who would be functionary of the Mormons. And Dawson comes into Utah Territory early in the Civil War, and he says, to show your loyalty to the Union, you guys ought to place a tax on this, that, and the other, and give the government money to support the war effort. And the Mormon legislature goes crazy with that. And they're not going to pay to fight the war that they think will destroy the United States. So things go downhill from there.
Downhill indeed. In 1861, Governor Dawson is forced to leave the Utah Territory. And why?
Well, the Mormons claim that Dawson has made a pass at his laundress, who was the widow of Thomas Williams, a controversial character, and she joined in charging him. And that is allegedly why Dawson, who was fleeing from Utah after 3 weeks, was beaten and, as George Q. Cannon said, half castrated at Mountain Dell, which was a stage station where Mountain Dell Reservoir is.
John W. Dawson, in December of 1861, was trying to flee Utah because, well, the locals didn't take too kindly to him. And on his way out, he was attacked by...
Well, it's attributed to the stage driver. And Moroni Clausen and Lot Huntington and a couple of other sons of powerful Mormons. And these kids are wild. They were young. They were teenagers. They were ready to go out and have a good time. And it was New Year's Eve. And I once wrote that John Dawson had the worst New Year's Eve in Utah history. What happens is Dawson gets to Fort Bridger. He's essentially crippled up. But he writes a letter to Abraham Lincoln charging that the Mormons have badly assaulted him. It's a perfect crime in many ways because he can't say, well, they have castrated me. And who knows what that means?
What's the documentation for the half castration again?
It's a letter from George Q. Cannon to Daniel Wells. He's Brigham Young's henchman, and he's commander of the Nauvoo Legion and is the enforcer. But anyway, so the kids come back to Salt Lake, and they don't think much of it. But then they're charged with horse theft, that they stole horses.
So basically, Tim, after these teenagers attacked Dawson, something has to be done to show that Utah isn't an entirely lawless territory, especially after Dawson writes this letter to President Lincoln.
So a posse is formed, led by famed Mormon bodyguard and lawman of sort, Orrin Porter Rockwell. In January of 1862, Rockwell and his posse track these teenagers down. They're trying to skip Utah territory and flee to California. Rockwell and his posse track them down to this Pony Express station about 20 miles due west of Utah Lake. One of them reportedly gets shot and killed in a gunfight. The two are brought back to Salt Lake City and again reportedly try to escape. They're both shot and killed there in Salt Lake City.
Okay, and that's where the story takes its turn and begins to head towards that fable. One of the kids who is killed by Orrin Porter Rockwell and his posse is buried at the expense of his family in the city cemetery. For the other guy, his name is Moroni Clausen. No relatives come to claim him, and so contemporary accounts show that a policeman paid to provide him with burial clothes and that then he was buried in a pauper's grave also in the city cemetery.
Yep, but then just a few days later, Moroni Clausen's brother shows up and says, "I want to bury my brother in our family plot down in Draper." So they dig him up and move him, but... he's naked.
Buried with the clothes a few days before, dug up naked a few days later.
An investigation is launched, and authorities seek out the sexton of the local cemetery. The sexton is not Jean-Baptiste, by the way, but someone named Jesse Little. He doesn't really matter too much to the story, other than the fact that he sends the lawmen sniffing down the door of gravedigger Jean-Baptiste.
Indeed. So authorities pay a visit to Baptiste's home on 3rd Avenue, and it doesn't take long for them to see the boxes and boxes and boxes of clothing. Some accounts say there were garments from around 50 bodies in Baptiste's home.
Now, grave robbing has always been a particularly taboo crime, but especially so in Mormon faith, because on Judgment Day, members of that faith are supposed to be resurrected in the clothes they're buried in. So it's really significant that they are in a presentable form when they rise up again.
Just bearing that in mind, as people in Salt Lake learn about the fact that this has happened and word spreads really quickly, they get extremely angry. They want Baptiste to pay dearly for his crime. In fact, as officials take him from his home to jail, residents gather on the street to jeer him. One guy even recognizes the suit Baptiste is wearing as the suit that one of his friends was buried in a couple of years before, which may have been the beginning of the legend about the suit in the shop window that I heard when I worked at the city cemetery, by the way. You might be wondering about the motive for this crime.
Why is he stealing clothing from the dead? because visitors passing through Utah, especially in the, during the Civil War, comment on how poorly clothed poor Mormons are. They say the women are practically naked, which is scandalous in Victorian times. But however, Jean-Baptiste was marketing his goods, he was probably making a fair penny at it.
So what happens to Baptiste?
Here we need to bring in another character, and maybe the most famous character in Utah history, Brigham Young. Again, here's historian Will Bagley.
We have contemporary documentation because Brigham Young gets up, and as he often did, in the old tabernacle, as it was called, and casts away Jean-Baptiste.
Everything Brigham Young says in the tabernacle is written down by scribes and then published in the Deseret News newspaper. So, we have all of his words.
Many are anxious to know what effect it will have upon their dead who've been robbed. I have three sisters in the graveyard in this city, and two wives and several children, besides other connections and near relatives. I've not been to open any of their graves to see whether they were robbed, and do not mean to do so. I gave them as good a burial as I could, and in burying our dead we all have made everything as agreeable and comfortable as we could to the eye and taste of the people in their various capacities, according to the best of our judgments. We've done our duty in this particular, and I for one am satisfied. I will defy any thief there is, on the earth or in hell, to rob a saint of one blessing. A thief may dig up dead bodies and sell them for the dissecting knife, or may take their raiment from them. But when the resurrection takes place, the saints will come forth with all the glory, beauty, and excellency of resurrected saints, clothed as they were when they were laid away.
Again, as we mentioned before, burial clothing was really important to the members of the Mormon faith because they were to be resurrected in the clothes they were buried in on the judgment day.
Some, I've been informed, can now remember having had singular dreams, and others have heard rappings on the floor, on the bedstead, on the door, on the table, etc., and have imagined that they might have proceeded from the spirits of the dead, calling on their friends to give them clothing, for they were naked. My dead friends have not been to me to tell me that they were naked, cold, etc., and if any such rapping should come to me, I should tell them to go to their own place. I have little faith in those rappings. If I felt that I ought to pay attention to such things, I would not, so to speak, let my right hand know what my left hand did, and it would require a greater power than John Baptiste to make me believe either a truth or a lie.
So Salt Lake City locals were understandably peeved and demanded justice. So they looked to their moral guide and spiritual leader, Brigham Young, for direction on what to do with this criminal who committed such an egregious crime.
It appears that a man named John Baptiste has practiced robbing the dead of their clothing in our graveyard during some 5 years past. If you wish to know what I think about it, I answer, I am unable to think so low as to fully get at such a mean, contemptible, damnable trick. To hang a man for such a deed would not begin to satisfy my feelings. What shall we do with him? Shoot him? No, that would do no good to anybody but himself. Would you imprison him during life? That would do nobody any good. What I would do with him came to me quickly after I heard the circumstance, and this I'll mention before I make other remarks. If it was left to me, I'd make him a fugitive and a vagabond upon the earth. This would be my sentence, but probably the people will not want this done.
But that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, the historical record shows that Baptiste was exiled to Fremont Island. We also know that he disappears from the island some months later. Maybe the stickiest part of this tale, though, is whether Baptiste was fitted with a ball and chain.
But it seems important to the fable of a man washing up on the shores of the Great Salt Lake being Baptiste. But yeah, you're right, Roger. No documentation from that time can say whether or not the skeleton found was the pariah himself. Here, though, is historian Will Bagley again with some more of the account of Baptiste's alleged escape from his island captivity.
So the story is that the police put a ball and chain, or at least some sort of restraint, so he can't just walk away from the islands. But at some point, somebody goes out to check livestock or some property, and Jean-Baptiste is gone. And there was allegedly a shack where some old mountaineer lived, and the shack had been torn down, and there was apparently a slaughtered beef whose hide had been dried, and that Baptiste would have built a bull boat, is what they were often called, out of hide and lumber, and then sailed for the shore.
Bagley might be laughing there because he's about to enter the realm of legend, Sleepy Hollow territory, basically. 28 years after our gravedigger disappears, in 1890, some duck hunters come across something at the mouth of the Jordan River as it feeds into the Great Salt Lake. They find a skull. And then 3 years later, in the same place, another hunter finds a skeleton, minus the skull, and attached to one of the leg bones is a ball and chain.
But do we know if it's Baptiste or not?
Well, the Deseret News publishes a story that calls into question that assumption. They find the policeman who brought Baptiste across to Antelope Island before he was ferried off to Fremont Island and his exile. And in 1893, these same policemen say that the grave robber had never been shackled with a ball and chain.
Okay, interesting.
Historian Will Bagley, though, says that it's not so cut and dry. It's possible, he says, that those policemen could have been covering up the truth of what happened, but that it's kind of impossible to say without, you know, some new information coming to light. Still, Bagley says it's a good story, and especially for this time of year.
Well, we've got a story. We've got a local myth, and it's one of Utah's only Halloween stories.
By the way, when I told Bagley about what my boss had told me at the cemetery, Tim, that Jean-Baptiste was dragging his chains around there, here's what Bagley said. It kind of echoes what you said before.
You would think if ghosts were real and Jean-Baptiste had really wound up on one of the Salt Lake Islands with a ball and chain, that he'd be haunting those islands. But maybe there's not anybody around to haunt.
Again, that was Will Bagley, a brilliant and prolific historian who helped us tell this story a couple of years back and who was always so generous with his time and knowledge. He passed away last month, and Will, you will be deeply missed. Thanks as well are due to my former co-producer, Tim Pierce, and also to voice actor Andy White, who brought the words of Brigham Young to life. And that's it for In the Hive here on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next week.